Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Ambassador Patrick Kennedy, Undersecretary of State for Management at the U.S. Department of State. Also joining us in our conversation is Bonnie Glick, Project Executive at IBM. Pat, given the release of the Joint State and USAID Strategic Plan of 2007 to 2011, could you tell us about the efforts to integrate USAID operations with those of the State Department? Specifically, how has this joint effort enhanced the ability of both organizations to ensure that the nation's foreign policy and development programs are fully aligned, and how has the effort impacted your bureau and its workload?
I think there's two separate aspects to that very good question. And let me take the logistical and administrative and managerial part first. Over the years, many AID operations have taken place in a separate building. And so when you have separate buildings, it is logical that there are quasi-separate administrative structures. Thanks to the Congress, we've built some 50 new embassies in that period of time. And as we've built a new embassy, we have made room so that the State Department contingent, the other agencies, and AID can be co-located on one compound. As we have done that, we have taken steps to streamline our activities. And so rather than two motor pools or two maintenance elements, we're now pulling all that together in a combined operation. And so that streamlining, which contributes to cost savings and effectiveness, is very important. So we're seeing state and aid co-located, and we're deriving administrative and managerial efficiencies from that. The other part of the strategic effort forward is the Secretary has taken steps to ensure that we have a very much of a holistic look. We have a strategic plan where the U.S. government should go overseas, and she's taken steps by creating a senior advisor to her on foreign assistance, Henrietta Fore, who also is the administrator of the Agency for International Development. So we're pulling two organizations together at the top and ensuring that AID knows where the State Department feels it needs to go in terms of foreign affairs support, and the State Department well knows and understands what important missions the Agency for International Development is engaged in terms of helping people in distress. By having a common strategic framework, we're able to make sure that state and aid are operating in tandem, and I think that contributes both to advancing U.S. interests abroad and also better helping people around the world, many of whom are in desperate need of such assistance.
Now, along similar lines, could you provide us an overview of such initiatives such as transformational diplomacy and your corporate right-sizing and regionalization strategies?
The Secretary feels, and I think she's absolutely right, that as the world has changed, as issues have changed, as countries that may not have been at the forefront of our thought or our topmost on our radar screen. So over the course of the past 3 years, we've gone through three exercises in which we have shifted resources from various parts of the world, Europe to some extent, to Asia, the Pacific, and the Middle East, and Africa. We call this global repositioning. The goal here is to make sure that we have positioned our personnel and our financial resources so that they are most strategically aligned with the foreign policy goals of the United States. And we do that by also making sure that not only has the focus in terms of countries changed somewhat, although let me emphasize that it's critically important that we continue to deal with our neighbors in the Western Hemisphere and our partners in Europe through such mechanisms as the European Union, NATO, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. So we're not abandoning parts of the world to move to others. We're simply realigning so that we get the best bang for the taxpayer's buck. But the second part of transformational diplomacy is to realize that there are additional issues out there. There's issues of science and technology, of aid, economic investment, energy, oil, and another means. So more and more, the State Department must, should, and is dealing with non-governmental groups. It's important to reach out to academia, to the media, to the private sector and to private sector organizations within countries, which are having more and more of an impact in their nation, just as in our country. Private sector entities have a major influence on how things happen in the United States.
Given the size of the department's budget, would you tell us a little about the department's efforts to improve its financial performance? And how has your organization expanded the use of financial data to inform its management decision-making process?
Another good question. We have a chief financial officer in Brad Higgins. Brad is an excellent CFO, and his focus has been to make sure that we can track every single dollar that we have, and he has accomplished that. We have installed a new financial management system in the department, our global financial management system. In the past, it was very much of a paper thing where papers were moving from one place to another, and if funds were expended overseas, it might be days, if not weeks, before we had an accurate snapshot of where the resources were at that moment. That's completely changing with the global financial system. We've moved to a common platform, electronic transfers, and so we're able now to know exactly where our money is going, and we're able then to shift it. The second part of that is we know that we need more data. We need to have data so that managers can make more informed decisions. And so colleagues in the chief financial office, our planning office, and our chief information office are working together to build a more robust data warehouse so that all the information that decision makers need is at their fingertips. And the third point is we're also collecting data in a more rigorous form. We provide administrative services, management services to some 50 different government agencies overseas on 165 different embassy platforms. All of them follow the same financial rules and input the same financial data. But to a degree, the definitions that they were using as they were counting something as either an apple or an orange or a fruit or a vegetable were just slightly different. And so through a process in conjunction with our regional bureaus and our posts overseas, we are tightening up that activity so that will then enable us to compare and contrast unit cost in doing business so that we can challenge our colleagues overseas and ask them the right question is, why is your unit cost different from another? Obviously, there may be reasons based upon geography or individual circumstances prevailing in a country, but we need better data and we're getting it so we can ask those tough questions.
That's great. Moving to a slightly different place where you have budget expenditures, the State Department's real estate portfolio exceeds $14 billion in value and, as you said, includes over 15,000 properties. And the State Department is one of only four federal agencies out of the 15 that managed to achieve a green for both status and progress in the president's management agenda for federal real property. Would you elaborate on this incredible achievement, and could you tell us about your efforts in this area, and what advice would you provide your colleagues in other agencies?
The State Department has unique challenges. Since we operate in so many countries in different circumstances, some places it is easy to rent good facilities, some places it's very, very hard. We do own a large number of properties overseas, and the first step that the Office of Overseas Buildings took was to develop an asset management plan so that we were sure that every property we had was being utilized to the maximum extent possible. So we analyze our properties in terms of their value against their utility, and that has led us in some cases to buy properties. It has led us in other cases to sell properties where the value of the property exceeded the utility. There were properties that we acquired right after the Second World War that had become so valuable that it was not necessarily we were getting that value out of them. So we've sold those properties and bought multiple other ones. And so we have achieved economies of scale against what we have to pay in leasing and rent. So I'm always hesitant to offer advice to the colleagues at other agencies. But I think the easiest thing, it's the simplest, is just to make sure if you've got properties, do you have a plan? Have you analyzed each property? Is that each individual property being put to its highest and best use. And if it doesn't fulfill your business needs' highest and best use, get rid of it. State Department also has one advantage that is not necessarily available to all other government agencies, is the Congress permits us, when we sell a property abroad, to reinvest those proceeds in the purchase of additional properties. So they've given us a wonderful incentive to be as efficient as we can, and we take advantage of that at every opportunity.
Now, Pat, I understand that consular officers around the world process over 7 million non-immigrant visa applications and nearly 700,000 immigrant visa applications each year. This strikes me as sort of an interesting challenge between maintaining security and facilitating legitimate travel. Could you tell us about your efforts to meet the security challenges associated with performing visa services, and to what extent does the Visa and Passport Security Strategic Plan outline these efforts?
We feel that we have absolutely two requirements laid upon us in the post, the passport and the visa. The first and the primary is to protect national security. Our consular officers are our first line of defense, both overseas and domestically in terms of passport issuance. Every applicant who comes in for a visa is interviewed. We use biometrics, working with the FBI. We now take what's called tinprint. We take fingerprints from every applicant, and those are immediately loaded into our technology system and go to the back to the FBI central files, as well as checks at Homeland Security. And no visa is issued if those fingerprints come back and say the individual is on anybody's warrant or watch list. Secondly, the name of every visa applicant and other data, such as date and place of birth, are entered into a separate database, which is run through the entire U.S. government data bank, so to speak. And so if that individual has any activities that are of concern to any element of the U.S. government, that issue is resolved either favorably by consulting with those agencies. Lots of people have the same name. People with the same name may even have the same date of birth, and so you have to resolve cases like that. But we don't issue a visa until we are sure that there is no one in the U.S. government who has concerns about that individual. Backing that up is the Bureau of Diplomatic Security. We have regional security officers and assistant regional security officers around the world. They are part of our frontline defense as well. They investigate fraudulent attempts to obtain U.S. visas. They're on guard against visa brokers and others who try to suborn the process. And so the consular workload and the visa investigations of diplomatic security work hand in glove to make sure that we have a robust and secure process at all times.
Now, Pat, I only have a minute left, but I want to bring us back to a comment you made earlier around the recent surge in passport applications. How has your department enhanced the passport application and delivery process, and to what extent does the transition to e-passports assist in this area?
We have increased by several hundred the number of passport acceptance agents around the country. It is important, though, that when you apply for a passport, we adjudicate your application. We make sure that you are who you say you are. So we've increased the number of personnel. We've opened a new production facility in Arkansas that has a capacity to produce 10 million passports a year. We also have added, in effect, SWAT teams. We have personnel trained in the State Department who don't do consular work or passport work on a daily basis, but they've been trained and they're deployed and they're, in effect, our ready reserve. And lastly, many applications for passports are renewals. Renewals are handled differently than first-time applicants because you've already been adjudicated once, and those are handled in an electronic process with the image on the screen of your original application, the image of your current application, and the image of your current passport. We have developed a way that if we should get hit with another surge, we can actually send that electronic work to our embassies around the world, and their consular officers working the night shift, in effect, will process those applications for renewals and then send the approved electrons back to one of our production facilities, and the passport would be issued the next day.
How does state manage its resources and infrastructure here and abroad? We will ask Ambassador Patrick Kennedy, Undersecretary of State for Management at the U.S. Department of State, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.